This podcast is part of the Neverland Network, where faith meets video games, movies, and fun. Find more shows like this at neverlandpodcast.com.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
From days long ago, from uncharted regions of the universe, comes a legend.
The dream that came through a million years, that lived on through all the tears.
It came here, the Fandom Nexus.
Fabulous secret powers were revealed to our host as he plugged in his microphone.
I have a podcast!
Here he is, your Spider-Pan, Jeremy.
Yes, hello, we are back. It's becoming a bi-weekly thing, but at least we are back. What all was going on last week? We got school started and everything, but yeah, I just didn't have the time, and also I wasn't quite in the mood. We had some things going on here that kind of threw me off last week, so I wasn't able to get a show going, but I am back this week, and we're going to have some fun. I brought my wife, Heather, with me again. Hello!
Hi!
So, it's more fun when I have a co-host, and I have a live-in co-host. Isn't that convenient?
Yes.
Okay. But today, although we do have to take a moment for a bit of a tribute, I was originally planning on last week having a bit of a follow-up to Gamescom 2025 in Germany and all the different announcements, including there's a handheld Xbox on the way around, which I'm not that... I'm sure plenty of people are interested in that. I'm not really. I mean, there is a handheld thing for the PlayStation 5 that would allow me to remote in on the thing, so that's kind of cool, but I don't necessarily need a handheld, but that's pretty neat. Like some sort of handheld version of something going to work with Xbox that was announced. The big announcement, of course, with the Lego Batman Dark Knight. I don't know. It's basically following every single Batman movie and everything. So that was pretty excited for that one. And of course, there was some more stuff for Resident Evil Requiem. But by now, if you're interested in that, you've probably already found out everything that happened at Gamescom. So you don't need me to tell you any of that. So instead, we're moving on to the next thing. We're going to go through some of my favorite songs from video games. And I'm not talking just the score. I'm talking a song that has lyrics, and maybe you even heard it on the radio, or at least it could have been on the radio. I mean, it is a full-fledged song, and I've got a collection of some of these. If I don't mention your favorite, you know what? We have an email address, and we have a Facebook group, and you can let me know, hey, I really like this song from this game, because I have not gotten to play every single game in the world, and some games I'm not interested in playing. I mean, if you heard something you thought you liked out of Grand Theft Auto, I'm sorry, I probably haven't played it, because I don't want to be the bad guy. So,
nope.
So that is what we're going to do today, of course, with a tribute to Graham Greene. So that is our current plan and everything. But I actually have some things to say for the what have you been watching? We sat around finally. I borrowed it from Philip because I had started watching this a long time ago on Netflix. And then I heard a podcast that kind of spoiled what was going to happen at the end of the movie that wraps up the series. But we started watching Firefly yesterday. Yep. And we watched, I guess it's almost like a four episode beginning because there's a part one and two that they just put together for the premiere. And then we watched one episode off the disc too. So we borrowed these DVDs and we're watching Firefly and rather enjoying it, having some fun.
Yeah.
We've become Kaylee fans. Kaylee's the cool one.
She's cute. She's very friendly and cute and amiable. And I don't know how you could not like her.
She's a lovable character. So I'm like, okay, hopefully everybody's going to get through this. And stuff. I wore it because like the first episode, we're like, oh, I kind of like this character. And then she got shot and we're like, what? No. But she's OK.
She's all right.
She's OK. But the last episode we watched really was it was great because she really liked this fancy dress thing. She really wanted to buy it. And then Mal and Nathan Fillion, he occasionally is just a jerk. And I've been frequently yelling at the TV, you need to apologize because he says. Yeah, because he said something, but he kind of made up for it because the way the story goes, she gets to have her nice fancy dress and go to a fancy ball. And
she was kind of the belle of the ball there.
With at least some of the guys, some of the people who weren't stuck up jerks, like some of these girls that were there. And so we appreciated that. So, I mean, the characters are really good. I do like the shepherd, or he's basically a pastor. He's a missionary or something like that. And Nathan Fillion, even when he acts like a jerk, you still kind of love him. He just
has that likable charm.
Yeah.
I mean, even when he's kind of being grumpy, you know.
Mm-hmm. Because he's Nathan Fillion and he can get away with stuff somehow or another. And then I always love Alan Tudyk. He's always funny.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, I love his first bit in the first episode, and he's playing with the dinosaur toys because he's bored on the ship. And he's like, what should we call this land? Do we, you know, he's just playing with these dinosaur toys. I was dying. It was so funny.
And then him and his wife are cute.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So him and Zoe are adorable because they're so much like different, because he's maybe a little weird like me. And then she's very serious and she's the soldier and everything. So they're kind of a weird.
Kind of opposite.
Yeah.
They're kind of opposites. Yeah.
Kind of like us, except for you're not a soldiery person, but we're kind of oppositely weird. And yet somehow or another it works.
Yep.
So, but yeah, so we've been enjoying that. And we hopefully we'll get through that maybe in a couple of weeks. Who knows? Well, you know, sit down and watch. We're not going to have time to watch an episode today. I don't think so.
Probably not.
But then also, I have an answer for the other typical question, what have you been playing? And I finally got Heather to sit down for another session on Final Fantasy VII Remake to play some more. We didn't record it this time for watching movies with my pastor or the alternate title, playing games with my wife. I do occasionally with her. I just wanted her to be able to sit down and just play the game and have some fun with it. So
I kind of feel proud of my bike jousting.
I guess it'd be
not really jousting.
She got through a scene where you're having to ride on the bike and have to fight through a few Shinra troopers. And then Roche of soldiers shows up to challenge Cloud because he's looking for a new rival. So, and she got through it.
Not too bad, though. Yeah. Like, I mean,
I'm still trying to teach you how to block.
Well,
if it wasn't for the boost, because there's a setting you can do it. You can put it on easy and then you can give yourself a boost. And it made her level 45, which the maximum level on Remake is 50. So she's nearly max leveled and on easy, and it gave her a bunch of extra stuff. So I mean, and for her not being good at games, no, I wouldn't want that much handed to me. I like to, you know, try to figure things out a little bit. But with you not playing much games, you got everything handed to you, and that's fine. So you're able to get through it, and I'm like, that's fine. But I want you to be able to get the more full experience.
We're focusing more on the story than necessarily all the nuances of combat.
But I want her to have fun playing it.
I don't block very well in any game I play, whether it's Zelda. Whether it's Stardew Valley and little slimes are coming at me, I don't know. That is just not something that my brain thinks, oh, I need to block. I'm just like, keep slashing until they're dead.
And button mashing might get you through all this. But I want you to be able to experience all the using the spells. And even maybe when you have like partner characters, because you can switch characters and do different things. You know, try out playing with some of the other characters in a fight, you know. Have some fun, because at least even with Aerith, you could kind of hang back and throw magic bolts at stuff. And you could have fun with that. And Tifa is... She doesn't even use weapons. She smashes monsters in the face with her fists.
Tifa smash.
It's one of the things that wouldn't work in normal, but in an anime style, it kind of works that she can kick a robot in the face, you know. So, but, you know, you get the fun of experiencing some of the other different characters and their combat styles. It's kind of just fun because you're getting to meet some of the characters. Have you got a slow favorite popping up so far of what characters are more fun?
No, not yet.
Not yet. Okay. Because we're trying to figure out if by the end of this, if she's going to be Team Tifa or Team Aerith. And not as far as whose relationship with Cloud, but if she'll be, like, pick one of them as like a favorite, because I figure you're probably going to relate more to maybe a female character. So you might be.
Them. I don't know. We'll
either
see.
That, or you'll
we'll
just think Cloud just has those dreamy blue eyes.
No.
It's
not
the Mako.
So much.
Not so much.
The stoic thing doesn't necessarily do much for me,
which is good for me because I am far from stoic.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
It's like I told you over the weekend. I like weird. You ought to be happy. I like weird.
Yeah. Otherwise, I'd be by myself. Okay, but I do have a bit of news here for you. Which button did I put the news sounder on here? Let's see this one.
Spanning the Disney and geek universe to bring you the best in comics, toys, movies, and entertainment. This is news from around Neverland.
Okay, so Wizards of the Coast has an article on their page about the upcoming Spider-Man Magic the Gathering set coming September 26th, which I'm trying to look to see where I've got maybe, because last time I burnt out my, I have a card, a store card for GameStop, and I burned it out buying Final Fantasy cards which is a good thing I did because I have not seen a single card in their store since. So I don't have what I need right now on that. But I got till the 26th. If I can save some money up, because I would like to at least get some starter packs, but looking at their website, I haven't seen where they have starter packs for Spider-Man, but I want to make sure I get some sort of pack from some Spider-Man cards that hopefully also I get a card that I can get to the Magic the Gathering Arena computer game and play with a Spider-Man deck or something. I want the whole nine yards, but a Spider-Man set. Looking a little bit on some of the websites, I mean, they're going to have one set that it's meant to where they don't have the borders on the pictures. And so you can put a big picture together and it's like Spidey and Doc Ock and Venom and all these ones where you can kind of put them together like the trading card sets back in the 90s. There was a set of the Marvel cards that you could put them arrange them in such a way where like there'd be an X-Men page of nine cards that you put them together and be like an image that kind of fit together. And they're doing stuff like that, all these sets coming out there, but they were also trying to represent some classic storylines with some of the cards. So I'm kind of wondering like what sort of things, you know, there's even something about Kraven's Last Hunt where they have double face cards representing some dual states. I'm not exactly sure exactly what's going on. So maybe you'd have a card that would be, say, they're talking about a card that might be Peter Parker on one side and Spider-Man on the other side. Now, I haven't played around with Magic where I have dual states. I have a few dual states cards, but I haven't really played with my cards. So the Final Fantasy ones, I've been kind of like keeping them nice. And I put my I ordered online to get some because I wanted the Aerith cards, obviously. So I ordered a nice foil one and I just put it in a sleeve thing. So this is going to be nicely protected. And I'm instead of playing with them, I use the computer version and I play with them on there. And I got to play with you one time because I got enough codes where you got a starter set of them, too. And then she didn't like it because she lost.
I didn't even have a chance.
You did. You had a really good thing going on. She put up all these dinosaurs.
That's because just what I drew.
Yeah. You had a nice thing of dinosaurs, but I actually had some stuff that I was able to tap her dinosaurs so I didn't have to deal with them. So I tapped her
didn't
dinosaurs
even let
and
me
then
use
attacked.
One.
Because she would have killed me. I have to try to win. I wasn't supposed to just roll over and die for you. But September 26th.
I didn't say you had to lose.
Oh, one of the other things. Infinity Stones are going to be added in here for part of the Magic the Gathering. Because you could mix and max your cards if you wanted to. I could have Cloud and Spider-Man in the same deck, you know, that kind of thing. But they do plan on having at least a Soul Stone. And I don't know, maybe they'll eventually have a few other Marvel characters slowly brought in. I'm not sure what the whole plan is. I mean, it'd be kind of neat to have an Avengers set, maybe an X-Men set, that kind of thing. But a Spider-Man set, obviously, I have to go and get some of those. I mean, obviously, if I didn't know
you
that
they have to.
Yes, I do.
Because
Spider-Man. If I'd have known that they'd have put that Lord of the Rings set out a while back, I would have been getting that, too. But I wasn't paying attention. And I probably only found out about the Final Fantasy set because I'm part of Final Fantasy fan groups. And so they were talking about, look at these card sets. Here's some of the artwork. Aren't this cool? I was like, that is cool. This is a Magic the Gathering set. So I started paying attention. And that was about that time that I found out there was a Spider-Man set coming out. I'm like, cool, a Spider-Man set. I want that one, too.
I feel like Lord of the Rings would fit better with Magic than like Marvel. Yeah, it seems like an odd mashup. You know, Magic is very fantasy. You know, Lord of the Rings is fantasy, like that kind of goes together.
Well, I think some other different type of role-playing games, they're trying to mix it up because if you can make a licensing deal, then everybody makes extra money. So she's making, this doesn't work very well on audio, but she's doing the little finger
the
things
little
like you're doing the money fingers. Money, money, money. But yeah, it works out pretty good because we end up buying stuff because these are, in the end, trading cards. And so it's fun to collect trading cards. And I used to collect trading cards when I was younger. I don't have most of the ones that I had. I can't remember what all happened to them. But it's fun to collect of characters. If you already are familiar with the characters, and since I have been playing through the all of the Final Fantasy main games, I'm more familiar with some of the characters that I've gotten in my kit. I don't think I have. There's some characters I'm like, I really like this character because I'm playing through six, and I like Locke and Saris. I want to say I'm not sure how you say her name, but she's like this former general or whatever of the Empire that has turned against the Empire and everything. And her storyline is really good. That, and then Terra, who I think she's supposed to be like the main character of the whole thing. And her story is pretty good too. But I'm like, I like these characters. I wouldn't mind having a card of some of these characters. There's actually really good characters as you get into these games. So, you know, it'd be nice to have them, but I don't think I got any cards of them, but I I would not have noticed them before when I got the card, so I might have to go back and look at them. But anyways, that's the only thing I grabbed for news, is the fact that that Spider-Man set is coming, and I want it. I do at least know a website I can go to. If you buy a pack and you don't get the cards you want, there are places you can order individual cards. I've even seen GameStop is selling some individuals cards where they've put them in plastic and graded them. And there's some Tifa cards right now that they're all graded that are going for a couple $1,000s already.
Mm.
And I think I've got some Tifa cards, but I don't know if I have those particular ones, but they're not as valuable if I haven't had them graded. But I don't get them to resell them. I get them to collect them and have them. So I am surrounded in a room here with stuff that I just have because I like to have them. And I keep some of it nice and in packages and stuff. And I have some of them that are out because I like to have them displayed. So because maybe the box doesn't display them very well. Like all my Aerith figures are all out over here. And I have a bunch of Spider-Man figures out on the other side of me, you know. But I have a lot of He-Man figures on the wall. It's that kind of thing. It's a toss-up. But I do open some toys. Okay, but I need to take a quick moment to tell you all about Dubby. If you go to NeverlandPodcast.com, you know what that is? That is the network home, the Neverland Network of podcasts, including this one, the Mighty Marvel Tooncast, as it is coming back. Oh, yes, it is coming back. We'll have some bonus episodes on Patreon for the Marvel Tooncast where we're going to watch some anime. And I'm not sure which one we're going to do first, because there's a fourth season of Shield Hero, but I want to watch the other one so everybody can get caught up with us, because we do recaps. And I feel like I need to get a recap of the first three seasons anyway. And I like the first three seasons, so we will have fun watching those. And we'll
I know a shorter series we could get into.
I want to watch Shield Hero. So, she's probably going to try to get me to watch something else that I might like or might not. I don't know. But I'll probably the first episode in Marvel. I'll get her. Somebody had requested a Hulk episode years ago, and Tim and I did record a Hulk episode, but we lost the recording. So we're going to have to rewatch the first episode of The Incredible Hulk from the 90s. And we'll do that one for our first episode as soon as we get a chance to record it. But, you know, of course, and then watching movies with my pastor is part of that network. It's all at NeverlandPodcast.com. But while you're there, you'll find a large white logo for Dubby. And if you happen to be a gamer and you need the energy, heck, if you just need energy overall and you just don't want the jitters, you need to use vitamins and healthy things to drink. And these have all these drink mixes of all kinds of different flavors there at Dubby. And you can get some nice bottles to put in your water and your mixes and get some healthy energy, some vitamins, and not a bunch of caffeine, okay? Because caffeine will kill you. So, but that's all at Dubby. And even if you just go to Dubby.gg, use the discount code Neverland to get your discount. All righty. And now let's do a quick tribute to Graham Greene. Now, if you don't know him by name, if you saw a picture of him, you're going to be like, oh, that guy. And that's kind of what I did with you yesterday. I said, like, if I said Graham Greene, would you know who that was? And
it sounded kind of familiar. Yeah. But then when I saw the picture, I was like, oh, yeah, I know that guy.
Because
yeah.
He had all these small parts and a lot of different things all over the place. I had ChatGPT help me out to gather some stuff. He was, of course, a groundbreaking Onida. I think that's how you say that. I think it's what tribe he was part of. Actor who left a profound mark on film, television, and theater. Rising from humble beginnings in the Six Nations Reserve in Ontario, Greene transitioned from trade work into acting, debuting in the late 1970s, and soon becoming an internationally recognized AP News. Oh, a recognized talent. That's from the AP News Wikipedia. So he's some noticeable roles he's played. It was Kicking Bird in Dances with Wolves back in 1990. His portrayal earned him an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor, and it remains his most iconic role. Then he was Arlen Bitterbuck in The Green Mile. I only watched Green Mile once because I didn't like the ending. That was from 1999 as a poignant and memorable performance in one of the most acclaimed films of the decade. Other key films would include Maverick. I think I remember him in Maverick because then they have like they put on a show of what we're supposed to be like in Indians, and like they'd act like, oh, how, and everything. And then they're talking normal to Maverick later, like, how long we got to keep doing this stupid little show for the tourists? You know?
Yeah, they got tangled up with them in that. Yeah,
he's also in Die Hard with a Vengeance. I think he was one of the feds. Twilight Saga, New Moon, never did see it. And Wind River, never even heard of it. But he would pop up in a lot of other ones. Usually mostly family friendly stuff. I think I'd see him in. He delivered a power performances in Reservation Dogs on television, something called 1883, The Last of Us, Tulsa King, and lent his voice to Chief Rainsfall in Red Dead Redemption 2. So, yes, has some video games in there, too. I don't know if I've come across that character in Red Dead Redemption 2. I haven't not completed that game because I keep getting stuck. And when I get stuck, I end up playing something else. He's also, this is kind of cool, he's a Grammy winner. He got one in 2004, a Listen to the Storyteller, a children's spoken word album.
Oh, I like that.
I wonder if he didn't maybe tell some stories, like his tribal stories.
That
and stuff
would be
like
wonderful.
That. He's a proud recipient of the Gemini and Canadian Screen Awards and Canada's Governor General's Performing Arts Award in 2025. Celebrated as a trailblazer for Indigenous actors, Green helped expand opportunities for authentic representation in Hollywood, earning tributes from peers and admirers. Graham Greene wasn't just a brilliant performer. He was a pioneer through a career spanning over 50 years. He portrayed characters with depth, nuance, and humanity, working tirelessly to elevate Indigenous voices in mainstream media. As DeFaro Woon Ai Tai from Reservation Dogs said, Greene showed us it can be done. You showed us how to leave your mark. I think Reservation Dogs, I think it's a streaming series. I think I remember seeing something about it, and it was supposed to be about some young people on a reservation. So, yeah, we're not going to remember him for just one role, but for a lifetime of artistry, integrity, and trailblazing leadership. And he's passed on September 1st, leaving behind quite the legacy.
That's sad because that's my birthday.
Yeah, he passed away on your birthday.
Did you know the last passenger pigeon also died on September 1st, like at the beginning of the 18th century or 19-something.
Weird thing you learned just because it was your birthday and you looked up any historical things?
No, I don't know. It caught, because it was my birthday when I heard, oh yeah, the last passenger pigeon died September 1st. It kind of stuck in my brain.
Well, okay.
It's sad.
Do you have any significant birthdays on your birthday that you know of?
Significant birth, like people or yeah. Whatever my birthdays?
Like John Wayne was born on my birthday. So it was George H. Bush was born on my birthday.
I don't know.
Star Wars was born a day before my birthday.
I have met a lot of people who have the same birthday as me. Like when I was in eighth grade, there were two other people in the school that had the same birthday. And it was a small school. Like we had 45 like students total from like, you know, 4 years old to senior. Like it was a very small private school. So, I mean, I meet people that have the same birthday as me often, but I don't know if I know of anybody famous. I know Keanu Reeves' birthday is in September, but I don't.
Yeah, he just had his. I think it was today. He's like 60 something. Yeah. Amazingly.
That's the closest that I know.
He is 60 something.
Yeah.
Dude. He doesn't. I hope I age that well. I seem to be aging. Nobody believes me that I'm 48. So
I don't know. He looks older. Like
yeah, when we've seen him when he was a young guy, no. But I mean, he's aged, but he's aging well. I would say he's aging very well.
If you say so. I don't necessarily agree, but I don't dislike it. He's older, you know?
Yeah, he is.
He looks like he's older, and that's okay.
He does, but he doesn't look bad for his age.
No.
Yeah. So some people age all leathery like Harrison Ford, but he wears his leathery well.
Yeah.
So and then Keanu Reeves is just aging pretty nicely. So, okay, but so video games, and I don't have these in any particular order, but as we get into more of a CD-ROM era, we were able to have songs in a game that would have lyrics, and it might sound something like you would listen to a radio. And so I've collected some of my favorites, and like I said, in no particular order, I probably should have sorted them in the top 10. And I just want to share some of these for you and hopefully brings back some memories for you as well. And then if you have a song that I don't include in this list, you can email us at podcast@neverlandpodcast.com or hey, join the discussion on Facebook. Let me know and say, hey, I really enjoyed that this game had this song in it. And some of these songs, I tried to maybe have some rules about that I want the song maybe written specific for the game, and most of them were. But some songs weren't written for the game. There's at least two songs that were not written for the game, but they fit the story of the game so well. And one of them is actually a cover of a song that fits very well with the story of the game. And one was actually an old kind of folk song that was sort of rewritten with new lyrics to make it fit the story of the game and actually tells
I know what
a
that one
story.
Is.
Yes, I know. I'm sure you know plenty of these, even though you have not played probably any of these games ever in your life.
The benefits of being your wife.
Yep. And that's remember that you said it's a benefit. Just remember you said that.
Okay.
Okay. Well, all right. So I'm going to kick this off. Now, this, I believe in the arcades, it was called Soul Edge and became Soul Blade on the PlayStation. And when we first booted this bad boy up, and people were discussing this actually in magazines, were asking, what's the best way to hook my PlayStation up to my radio so I can get a tape and record this song? Because, wow, it's amazing. But the song is simply called Edge of Soul.
Carry on, one of the from the bird is gone.
I have to be quick on hitting the pause button because it's just going to like flow to the next one here. Okay, so the music for Edge of Soul was composed by Masahiro Oki, who was credited under the stage name Benton Maru. He was a Japanese musician and band leader. He unfortunately did pass away, though, in late 2024. The song was performed by the rock band Con, who was a group specifically formed for the game soundtrack. Lead vocalist for the track was Suzy Kim. The band's other members at the time included Masahiro Oki and Mickey. The production, of course, Soul Blade is the PlayStation port of the arcade fighting game Soul Edge. The game was developed and published by Namco with the development team known as Project Soul, which would later become the official name for the series development team. Soul Blade was released for the PlayStation in Japan December 20th, 1996, and in North America on January 15th, 1997, and in Europe in May of 1997. The key feature of the PlayStation version was the Con Super Session soundtrack, which featured a new set of rock-oriented songs, including Edge of Soul, in addition to the original arcade score. This was a major selling point and helped establish the game's unique identity. Now, I did not know that you got a CD with this, because I think... because I played it in the arcade and had fun playing the game in the arcade, and I bought a copy of it used, and I think we had rented it one time, like over my birthday over weekend. Like me, Philip, and Seth were over here, we were just playing the Dickens out of that, just having a good old time. It was a fun game. It was kind of like a, well, similar to like Tekken, only with weapons. And the game series has continued on, and they'll do a special like Nintendo GameCube when they had a version. They'd had Link as a playable character. I think Kratos was a playable character at some point. On the PlayStation, but yeah, like for they would get an exclusive character from each company as they put it on there, and they would put that character into a Soul Blade game or Soul Edge game. And it's basically a saga about this evil sword that needs to be destroyed, but it never seems to get destroyed. It always gets passed on and corrupts somebody. So it was a fun game. And there's one character I think I like playing as Sophitia, because if you got the right color scheme, she looked like Xena Warrior Princess, and I was a fan of that show, and so I was like, dude, it's like I get to play as Xena and everything, so it was pretty cool. But I played a lot of that, but that opening song just really is good, and the version I have, I think it's from the CD, and the lyrics are both in English, and then it repeats in Japanese. So, and you've heard that one before, I'm sure it's played in the car plenty of times.
Yeah, it's played in the car.
It's
a
very
lot.
Anime style. Okay, read off what the next song is as I cue it up to play. Can you see it from here?
Okay, so it's Time Only Knows from the Prince of Persia. Sands of Time.
Yeah, that's the one. And here we go. And it's tried to hop away again on me. Okay, so now the cool thing about this song is the kind of the bass line sounds very James Bondy to me. You didn't catch that vibe?
I don't know. I don't know if I listened to that. You pick up things like audibly that I don't pick up. You have a better ear than I do.
Well, it does have that sort of Middle Eastern flair.
Yeah.
And some of it, but like this under, you know, like the under guitar, not quite the bass line, but it's like a lower part, just sounds like something that would be in a James Bond movie. But if you can read.
Okay.
About this song.
So the music for Time Only Knows and the entire soundtrack for Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, was composed by Stuart Chatwood. Chatwood is a multi-instrumentalist who is a member of the Canadian rock band The Tea Party. That sounds like fun. Tea Party, I like that name. He's known for incorporating Middle Eastern influences into his music, which was a perfect fit for this game. Lead vocalists for the song Time Only Knows were performed by Cindy Gomez. I know I like singing along with it. I don't know why it just pulls me in. I just want to sing along with it. Yeah.
I think this is, other than like Soul Edge, this is like a song when I got the game and there was a thing to just watch the credits and I did it. And that song started playing. I was like, I think I was like, Heather, come hear this. Like, and they, yeah. I think even on the GameCube version, you could watch some behind the scenes video of them recording the song with her. Yeah. But it's kind of impressive how good it is. But.
So the game production. Okay, The Prince of Persia, Sands of Time was developed by Ubisoft Montreal and published by Ubisoft.
Ubisoft, I think.
Oh, Ubisoft?
I think so.
Oh, okay.
I hear it pronounced both ways, but I think it's supposed to be Ubisoft. I don't know. Somebody's probably yelling at their phone right now. Go ahead. Keep going.
My apologies.
I'm sorry
if I mispronounced that.
We're not that worried.
The game was released in November 2003 for the PlayStation 2, GameCube, Xbox, and Microsoft Windows. The game was a major reboot for the Prince of Persia series, which originally was created by Jordan Mechner. Mechner worked on the game as a creative consultant, designer, and scenario writer. The production was built around the core gameplay mechanic of the Dagger of Time, which allows the player to rewind time. This idea was a crucial element that influenced the game's design, story, and even its music. The game was a critical and commercial success and is widely regarded as one of the best action-adventure games of its era. And I know I enjoyed watching you play it.
Yeah, it was a difficult game, but we did watch the Disney movie based off of it.
Yeah, we did.
Lightly based off of it.
I think we watched it in the movie theater even.
No, we rented it here. No, we didn't get to the theater. So Jake Gyllenhaal and, that one redheaded actress that she was in a James Bond movie briefly. She was in one of the Daniel Craig movies, like the second Daniel Craig movie.
I don't remember.
I think she dies almost, she like, instead of being painted up in gold, I think she was covered in oil.
Okay. That one.
Her name's like Gemma something, I think.
Oh.
Gemma Atherton? I don't know. I'm probably getting it wrong. But they had her and like, okay, so she's fair skinned and redheaded naturally. And they tried to make her look like an Arabic princess. There were some people who had some problems. It was very because like Jake Gyllenhaal, clearly not Middle Eastern, not Persian. Yeah. So there were people upset with that. And I understand. But it was an entertaining movie. It wasn't as great as it could have been because they diverted a lot from, of course, the game storyline.
It was a fun movie for what it was.
Yeah, it was fun for what it was, yeah.
It's hard to do that game in a movie style because of, especially that one, like you can rewind time, you can do all of these things. Like there's definitely a manipulation that occurs that it's very hard to do in a movie.
Yep. All right, next on the list is, now this song actually was written specifically to be in this game, but the song was such a big hit that they did release it later. And this is Breaking Benjamin with Blow Me Away, which I think they released as a single even. I'm trying to pause it in time, but it keeps wanting to jump ahead. Okay. Oh, I clicked the wrong thing. There we go. All right. So the song Blow Me Away was written by Benjamin Burnley, the band's vocalist and guitarist, and Jeremy Hummel, the band's drummer at the time. The song was specifically written and recorded for the Halo 2 soundtrack, as Benjamin Burnley is a self-described huge gamer. The band worked with producer David Bendith on the track. So the song was performed by, of course, the band Breaking Benjamin, as said. The band's lineup at the time was Benjamin Burnley on vocals and rhythm guitar, Aaron Fink as lead guitar, Mark Klip. Klepaski on bass, and Jeremy Hummel on drums. Now, the cool thing is, like, when you, I'd gotten familiar with the songs because I started collecting the songs because the music in Halo was actually pretty good. I'm not a huge Halo fan, like some people are, but there's a level that when you get into a heat of battle, the song starts playing without the lyrics, and it kind of inspires you to keep going. But I kept getting my butt kicked.
was this slaughtered. The Halo that you guys had me play like multiplayer and you totally turned me into fodder?
Well, Philip and I used to like to play Halo together just one-on-one and maybe some Halo 2. I don't know. Well, you might have played with us sometime.
I don't know. I just know it was a Halo game. I would play with you guys and it was you and Phil and I was just absolute fodder.
We were trying to be nice.
But you like to win.
But we like
you just
to
said
win.
It.
I would not be as aggressive. Philip, though, is one. He's what we call a camper.
Yeah.
He will sit and wait in
he
one spot. He's such a camper.
In that one, he was.
That's supposed to be a big no-no. But, oh, well, we don't care. It's just among us. We're not online, so people don't yell at us for doing stuff like that. Ken was a big camper on GoldenEye. Oh,
yeah,
my goodness.
I think I remember. We played.
We played with that. And
with a little bit, yeah.
He knew of one spot that he could sit where he'd be completely hidden. He would sit there and pick us off when we couldn't figure out where he was.
Yeah.
And he kept doing it. And he was, because he was the one that owned the game, so he knew where these spots were, and we didn't know anything.
Yeah.
And he was the one picking the levels. So, I mean, that's where camping becomes a problem, when he's like, nobody knows what's going on. And, you know, I'm going to pick this level, and I know exactly where to sit, and you'll never find me. Ha, ha, ha. That's when camping becomes a problem. It's like, now you're not making an even ground as best you can.
Either way, on skill alone.
Yeah. So Halo 2 was developed by Bungie and published by Microsoft Game Studios. The game was released November 9th, 2004 for the Xbox and later the Microsoft Windows in 2007. Halo 2 was a highly anticipated sequel to Halo Combat Evolved and was a massive commercial success, breaking sales records and becoming a defining title for the Xbox. The game's soundtrack was a major component of its production, with the main themes composed by Martin O'Donnell and Michael Salvatore. The Halo 2 original soundtrack album, however, was notable for its inclusion of tracks by popular rock and metal bands, including Blow Me Away, and others by Incubus, Hoobastank, and more. This was a unique approach for a game soundtrack at the time and helped to cement the game's cultural impact. Look, it's Heather's favorite song coming up.
You did that on purpose.
No, I did not. I these are not in any particular order. I just started as normal. You know you like this song.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is No Promises to Keep from Final Fantasy, and you'll have to remind me which one is this.
Seven Rebirth.
Seven Rebirth, okay.
Yep.
Till the day.
Sorry, I clicked the wrong thing to bring up the notes again.
Okay, so the music for No Promises to Keep was composed by a legendary Nobuo Uematsu.
Did better than I did trying to say that guy's name.
Oh, well, I did take like some Japanese.
Yeah, you're trying to learn
because
she wanted to read some manga.
Yeah. He's the original composer for the majority of the Final Fantasy series, and his work on the original Final Fantasy VII soundtrack is what made him a household name among gamers. The lyrics were written by Kazushige Nojima, the scenario writer for Final Fantasy VII and Rebirth. The lyrics are deeply tied to the plot and the character of Aerith, which they are. I will agree. Yeah, they are.
Very much.
The vocals for the song were performed by American singer Lauren Allred. She's best known providing the singing voice for the character Jenny Lind in the film The Greatest Showman, and she was performed the song Never Enough. Interesting, while the character Aerith Gainsborough is voiced by Brianna White in the game, Lauren Allred was specifically brought in to perform the singing parts. Allred has spoken in interviews about how she studied Aerith's character to channel her personality and emotions into the song's performance. Final Fantasy VII Rebirth was developed by and published by Square Enix. The game is the second part of a planned trilogy of remakes of the original 1997 Final Fantasy VII. A creative staff included Yoshinori Kitase.
As producer.
Naoki
Hamaguchi.
Hamaguchi. I'll get it. Hang on.
I can read some of these, kind of.
Well, I'm off to the side, so I'm doing the best I can. Tetsuya Nomura.
As creative director.
And as creative director. Okay. Yeah. So No Promises to Keep serves the game official theme song and is central to the memorable and emotional scene at the Gold Saucer. The song's title itself is a meta-commentary on the game's narrative, hence its story's themes of fate, destiny, and the promises, or the lack thereof, made throughout the saga. The song is a modern take on the operatic scene from Final Fantasy VI, but with an even deeper connection to the characters and their journey.
Yeah, and is often mistaken as being aimed at either Zack or Cloud or someone in particular, but the writers have said no. It is aimed at all of her friends because she had not gotten to have friends. Mm-hmm. So when you play it, and I want you to get to it too, she's kind of having the time of her life because she's finally getting out and doing things and having friends that she's close to. And we're getting close to the end of the game when this happens, really, to where some final things going. And it's almost like the fact that there's no promises. It's what I call a Disney I Want song.
It's almost kind of like her swan song, though,
it
too.
It is. But it's like saying goodbye, but it's until we meet again. It's not because she's got some foreknowledge. You're going to kind of notice that she kind of knows what's going on, although she does lose some of that in Rebirth because her white materia. I don't want to spoil stuff when you get to it, but she kind of seems to have some foreknowledge in her. Mm-hmm. She knows kind of what might happen to her. But it's like instead of saying this is my goodbye to you, this is come find me, which is what we're leaning on in part three. I'm glad I'm not the only person who can be upset. It's like, there's people who've started Aerith Lives campaigns on X. I almost said Twitter. So, and I have participated. It's like, you remember when the previews for the thing, when I was seeing suddenly Zack was suddenly alive again. I was like, you better save her. Of course, he wasn't there. So it didn't quite play out the way I thought.
Do we need to explain why you say this is my favorite song? Favorite song?
It's really good, though.
It's
not a bad song.
It's just that there was a period of time when every time I got in the car, it doesn't matter where.
She's kind of exaggerating.
Wherever, every time we got into the car, it didn't matter how long in between, this song would kick up because Jeremy was all about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth.
Here's the thing. When I first got the game, all I got was the mini soundtrack. So I only had a handful of songs. And then I went and I took, because they had not released the single of this song. I went to her performance at the Gamescom or the Game Awards. She performed it. I took an audio of that one and I just mixed it in with a CD that literally has like maybe six songs and that. So it's going to just loop those. So your odds were 1 in 7 pretty much that it's going to be in there.
In the end, it got a little overplayed on me until I said, like, hey, you know, like we hear this every time we get into the car.
And every time I was in the car, I was not hearing it. It just, and it wasn't every time she got in the car. She's exaggerating. She's just getting annoyed. She just gets annoyed.
Yes, it was. But you were nice. You gave me a break. So,
but it's really good though.
Like I said, I never said it wasn't a bad song. There are songs that I have played until I got sick of them because it was so good that I just ate it up and eventually was like, yeah, I gotta take a break from this.
And it's not very good just because, oh, look, my favorite character gets to sing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's had nothing to do with that either. It was just actually really good. Following on the heels of that is Hollow from Final Fantasy VII Remake. You would appear, reach out to me, heal every wound, and make me whole. Now, this is a song that I think why a lot of people say that the remake trilogy feels more like a sequel, because this is supposed to be Cloud feeling guilt and mourning over the loss of Aerith, which at this point in the trilogy games has not happened. So they're wondering why. And it fits more with Cloud, how he is. If you watch Advent Children, he's very guilt ridden that he was right there, but didn't save her, which is a grievous error, which I feel like in Rebirth they do try to change that.
Well, isn't he missing his memories? So I mean, like, he's got his memory because of that, you know.
No,
like,
well, being hollow has to do with Sephiroth says, you're hollow, you're just my puppet, you don't have any real. He even tells him at one point in the original game when Aerith dies, I mean, they took some of this dialogue out, you don't quite get all of it in Rebirth, but he tells him like, oh, don't pretend that you have any feelings. You're just my hollowed puppet.
Mm.
So he's called hollow because he doesn't seem to have much emotion the way you say he's very stoic, but he does have it. But like in the Advent Children movie, he can't seem to move on in his life that he has with Tifa and these two kids that are kind of taken care of because he is guilt ridden. And there's a really great scene in the movie because Aerith, her spirit still goes around and basically she's like, what am I supposed to forgive you for? You're not guilty. So I don't hold you responsible. And it's this really great little scene. It's just like it finally, and it changes. He goes back to go and face the Sephiroth clones, basically, that are in that movie. But it's this really crucial scene. But you kind of get like, oh, that's what Cloud's issue is at this point, is he feels guilty because he was right there. And Sephiroth is still trying to control him. Sephiroth's trying to make him kill her. Mm. And he's like, no, because part of him's like, what? No. And so he's resisting. But because he's resisting, Sephiroth says, fine, I'll just do it, and comes down from on high, and Cloud is unable to do anything to save
Spoilers?
Her. For a game that's 20 years old, that's the way it plays out originally.
Okay.
20-year-old plus game. Okay. I'm not spoiling things. More 25 years, really. Now, Rebirth, it does give you a chance where you see something could change that. So there is at least some reality that he does block Sephiroth. How that's going to play out, we won't know until third game. But dadgummit, there's at least some scenario where Aerith is okay. And they better let her be okay, because a lot of people are going to be pissed off. Anyways, okay. I'm supposed to be Heather pointing at the screen. You're supposed to be reading the screen. So the music for Hollow was composed by Nobuo Uematsu, the legendary composer of the original Final Fantasy VII and many other titles in the series. Uematsu's involvement was a huge deal for fans, as he only composed the main theme for this game and left the rest of the soundtrack to other talented composers. Masashi Hamazu. And then the other guy, I like this other guy, this Misuto Suzuki has been doing music in these two games, and I've really enjoyed his stuff too. But this made Hollow a standout piece and true gift to the fans. The Japanese lyrics were written by Kazushige Nojima, the scenario writer for the game. English lyrics were translated by Ben Sabin and John Crow. The song's meaning is directly tied to the themes of loss, emptiness, and the character's struggles. Vocals for the song were performed by Yosh. Lead vocalist of the Japanese rock band Survive said the Prophet. Yosh's raw and emotional delivery perfectly captures the melancholic and hopeful tone of the song, making it a fitting conclusion to the first part of the remake saga. Now, one thing that it kind of bugs me at the end when he finally gets to the title of the song or whatever, he is howling and hollow instead of just a hollow tour. It's like, if you didn't know he was trying to say hollow, you'd completely lose it the way he pauses in the middle of the word. And that bugs me just a little bit, the way he does that.
That doesn't bother me.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just weird. And even I've seen people on YouTube, they try to do a cover of it, and they do the exact same way. And I'm like, you don't have to perform it the same way Yosh did. You could kind of do it different. But I'm not taking it away from this Yosh guy, because he does do a good job.
Yeah.
I mean, so nothing away from him. All right, game production. Final Fantasy VII Remake was developed and published by Square Enix, in case you didn't know from the previous with Rebirth. The game was released April 10th, 2020 for the PlayStation 4. An enhanced version, Final Fantasy VII Remake Integrated, was released for PlayStation 5 and Windows 2021. Key staff from the original game returned for the remake. We already read all their names. The game's production was a massive undertaking as it reimagined the first few hours of the original game as a full standalone experience. This allowed the developers to expand on the story, characters, and world in an unprecedented detail, a decision that directly impacted the game's expansive soundtrack and the creation of a new emotionally resonant tracks like Hollow. And this game got me through COVID. Big time. You know, this is, and it was nice having that extra $600 thrown out. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to reserve this thing at Best Buy. I'll get the nice steel book package. And we waited in Best Buy out in the parking lot because they had to bring it out to us because we weren't allowed inside the store. Mm-hmm. So, and I popped the little soundtrack in to kind of listen to it. And that's the thing. It's like, I never finished it in 97. It's like, I don't know. Am I interested in a remake? But the more I looked at that remake, I was like, you know, I actually kind of am excited to play this and just love the heck out of it. I played it through multiple times. I cannot platinum the thing for the life of me. But there are some mini games I cannot do. So, yeah, this is Heather kind of almost not caring. Although she's been playing it. And you've been having fun playing it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I saw the title on the next one that you're also making me announce.
Oh, yes. All right. Well, go ahead and let you talk about the next game, I guess, that you
on my list of other songs that I'm not a big fan of, Still Alive by...
From Portal.
Oh, From Portal. Okay, I was trying to...
Satisfaction. Aperture science. We do what we must because we can.
She doesn't quite have the dark sense of humor that I do, I guess.
No, I don't.
To get this. So. You don't even like Jonathan Colton, but go ahead, read.
So the song was composed and arranged by Jonathan Colton. Colton is a well-known singer-songwriter and musician in the nerd folk genre. His humorous and often geeky songs had already developed a cult following online before he was approached by Valve. He was a fan of Valve's Half-Life series and was commissioned by the company to write a song for the game's credits. The song was performed by Ellen McLean, who is also the voice actor for the game's main antagonist, GLaDOS. McLean is a trained operatic soprano, and her performance was intentionally modified to sound computerized, which perfectly fits GLaDOS's character. The deadpan yet melodic delivery of the dark, funny lyrics is a huge part of the song's appeal. And it's the dark part that I'm not a fan of.
Yeah.
game production Portal was developed by and published by Valve. The game was released on October 9th, 2007 as part of a compilation called The Orange Box, which also include Half-Life 2, Episode 2, and Team Fortress 2. The game's origins are unique. It was a spiritual successor to the student game called Narbacular Drop, which was created by a team in the DigiPen Institute of Technology. Valve was so impressed with their game that they hired the entire team to develop Portal. Portal was a runaway critical and commercial success, praised for its innovative puzzle mechanics, sharp writing, and minimalist yet effective storytelling. The game's simple concept, using a portal gun to solve a physics-based puzzles, was genius. The ending and the song, Still Alive, were a masterful stroke of the game's design. It subverted players' expectations by having the main villain song sing a song over the credits, a move that was both hilarious and genuinely surprising. The song's lyrics brilliantly summarize the events of the game from GLaDOS' perspective, providing a final unforgettable punchline to the entire experience.
As she says, I'm still alive.
Yeah, that's the part I don't like.
Well, because she comes back.
Yeah, she's mocking you, you realize.
Yes, she's totally Mother Gothel from Tangled. total Mother Gothering list. Like, oh, I was so happy for you, then you burned me.
Hmm.
I was like, oh, well, maybe you'll find somebody else to help you. Sure. And there's even the joke that there's a Half-Life joke in there. So maybe Black Mesa, because Black Mesa is where the whole incident in Half-Life takes place. So it's the whole thing is this like backhanded thing. It's like, oh, I'm so happy for you. You got out of here. And we've made a nice little gun, a portal gun, you know. Yeah. All right. So keeping on the portal train from Portal True, we have What You Got.
Goodbye, my only friend. Oh, did you think I meant you? That would be funny if it weren't so sad. Well, you have been replaced.
The song was composed and written by Jonathan Coulton, who also wrote the iconic Still Alive from the first game. Coulton worked closely with the Valve team, including writer Eric Wolpaw, to create a song that would perfectly fit the game's ending. The lyrics are a direct reflection of GLaDOS's decision to finally release Shell, but in her own sardonic, passive-aggressive way. The song's main chorus, I used to want you dead, now I only want you gone, was a direct result of the game's finale, where GLaDOS effectively breaks up with the player. So the vocals were once again performed by Ellen McLain, the voice actor of GLaDOS, as with Still Alive, her performance is a masterpiece of deadpan humor and robotic emotion, which was different because this is more emotional. The song's tone is both genuinely emotional for a killer AI and hilariously insulting, a testament to McLain's ability to embody the character so completely. Because see, this one, the tone is very different because now it's the evil robot has the personality of Shell's mother in there. And it's I only want you gone is almost her way of like, I love you. Goodbye. Go live your life. She's really saying when you break it down, she's saying, go have a life. That's what I'm counting on. But she's like, I'm counting on you leaving me alone. No, it's I'm counting on you going and having a life now and go. But like right before this, she tries to delete all of little Caroline's memories from her databanks. But apparently there's something left. And that's when you get the song, it's actually this deep emotional thing on the song. You kind of get it's a mother's love, but stuck in this evil AI program at the same time. So that's why it's, I want you gone. I want you be free. And the funny thing is at the end of the game, as you're standing there as Shell, a companion cube is tossed out to her. So she's not alone. Here, have a companion cube. Bye.
Okay.
So it's a different thing. Well, you just wanted to rush me along, but that's kind of the fun of the point of that song. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you have to get the subtext to really appreciate everything that they wrote in there. Anyways, Portal 2 was, of course, developed, published by Valve. The game was released April 2011 for Windows, Mac OS, PlayStation 3, and Xbox 360. The game directed by Joshua Weir, and the main writers were Eric Wolpaw, Jay Pinkerton, and Chet Falaschek. Portal 2 was a massive production compared to the original, expanding the world, characters, and gameplay mechanics. The game's story was much longer and more complex, featuring a new antagonist in Wheatley, voiced by Stephen Merchant. If you saw a picture of him, you know who he was. He's very funny. And the voice of Aperture Science founder Cave Johnson, voiced by J.K. Simmons. You know who that is.
I know who that is. Yeah.
He's really funny in this, too. He's just basically recordings that Cave Johnson had made. Cave Johnson, it turns out, was Shell's father, most likely. So the game's soundtrack was primarily composed by Mike Morosky, but Jonathan Coulton's credit songs were a key part of the experience, serving as a perfect bookend to the series. The inclusion of Want You Gone provided a satisfying emotional conclusion and a final punchline for the player's long and arduous journey through the dilapidated Aperture Science facility. Okay, well, here's a song you don't mind as much, right?
Yeah, I know this game, I watched you play more than... Did I play some of it?
No, you didn't play any of it, but you were there when I woke up thinking something was jumping over the bed after I've been playing this game.
I thought I started playing it a little bit.
You didn't start playing, but you sat with me through it because we were intrigued by the story and what was going to happen. And this is when I was half asleep one night in bed and I jumped up thinking something was jumping over your side of the bed. And
yeah, but I still feel like maybe I started. I didn't finish it, but I feel like I maybe started it a little bit. Anyway, so Alone in the Dark from the series Alone in the Dark, The New Nightmare.
I stopped it in time. Look at me go.
Okay, the music for Alone in the Dark, The New Nightmare, was composed by Stuart Copeland. Copeland is best known as the co-founder and drummer for the iconic rock band The Police. He has also composed music for numerous films and TV shows, making him a versatile artist outside his famous band. The game's soundtrack also had contributions from Thierry Desireaux and Jean Sebastian Rossbach. Vocals for the main theme, Alone in the Dark, were performed by Jimmy Wood. Wood is a musician known for his work in the band Imperial Crowns and a harmonica player and vocalist who has collaborated with various artists. His gritty bluesy performance adds a unique foreboding atmosphere to the song that fits the game's survival horror genre. Alone in the Dark, The New Nightmare was developed by Dark Works and published by Infogrames. The game was released in 2001 for the PlayStation, Dreamcast, and Microsoft Windows. A Game Boy Color version was also released. This title was a reboot of the classic Alone in the Dark series, which is considered a pioneer of the survival horror genre. The New Nightmare completely changed the game's setting from the 1920s to a more modern early 2000s setting and adopted a fixed camera, pre-rendered background style similar to the popular Resident Evil series, which it was clearly influenced by. This change was a deliberate attempt to modernize the series and appeal to a wider audience. The game's plot follows paranormal investigator Edward Canby.
Carnby.
Yeah. Again, I'm at an angle and far away. And academic Aline Cedrak as they investigate a mysterious island and a strange supernatural phenomena.
Phenomena. Do, 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 do.
Phenomena. Phenomena.
Do, 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 do. Okay. I can't help it every time I hear that. Now, this actually also did get a movie based off of this game with Christian Slater.
Yeah.
But it tanked bad. They didn't do a very good job of adapting. And unfortunately, we didn't get the follow-up sequel that the end of the game kind of seems to promise. And Alone in the Dark keeps getting rebooted again and again and again. And the more recent reboot, even though I was kind of excited for it, apparently wasn't that good. And that even has David Harbour as Carnby. And you know David Harbour from Stranger Things, and also in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, we know him from.
Yeah,
you haven't seen any of his Marvel movies though, because you didn't see Black Widow, where he was Black Widow's like kind of father figure. He was like the Russian version of Captain America. I forgot who the character is. He's like Big Red or something. I can't remember what it is, but he's basically the Russian's Captain America, only older. So, yep. But David Harbour.
A good story. The game had a good story.
Yeah, it really did. It was really cool and scary. Oh, my goodness. Jump scares that would get you. Golly.
Scared you.
Yes. Scared you, too, when you came in. But, geez, I've gotten better about not getting jump scared as easily, though, as time has gone on. So now we have Snake Eater from Metal Gear Solid 3. Also, Metal Gear Solid Delta recently released. And I got to find it on my list. Here we go. Now, can you tell the James Bondiness of that?
No.
I mean, they totally went James Bond. It's awesome.
Yeah, no, I know.
I mean, that's so cool. So the music for Snake Eater was composed and arranged by Norihiko Hibino. Hibino is a Japanese composer and musician who worked on a number of Konami titles, but his work on the Metal Gear Solid series is his most well-known. The game's director, Hideo Kojima, wanted a James Bondish theme for the game, and Hibino's track was one of those that perfectly captured that cinematic espionage feel. The song's composition, with its powerful brass, strings, and subtle jazzy elements, is a direct homage to classic spy movie themes. The song's lyrics were also written by Norihiko Hibino. The song's iconic vocals were performed by American funk and soul singer Cynthia Harrell. Remember that name. Harrell is a friend of Rika Morinaka, a composer and producer who worked with Konami. Harrell's powerful and dramatic voice was exactly what the team was looking for to give the song its grand cinematic quality. Her performance is so impactful that it's often mistaken for a real James Bond theme song. Fun fact, Cynthia Harrell, I feel like I'm spoiling something that's coming, but I also performed the closing theme, I Am the Wind, for another Konami title, Castlevania Symphony of the Night. I wonder if we're getting to that one later.
I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. So Metal Gear Solid 3 Snake Eater was developed by Konami Computer Entertainment Japan and published by Konami. Game was released 2004 for the PlayStation 2. Yeah, I guess it was PlayStation 2. I was thinking of Castlevania was on the original, but yeah, that was PlayStation 2. I never finished this one, but I want to get Delta so I get a chance to play it. The series creator and director Hideo Kojima was the driving force behind the game's production. He wanted to take the series in a new direction, setting it in the 1960s during the Cold War. The game's production was a massive effort to create a realistic jungle survival experience. Key gameplay mechanics included camouflage, close quarter combat, and a survival viewer that allowed players to manage hunger and injuries. The game's narrative serves as a prequel to the entire Metal Gear saga, exploring the origins of Big Boss and the tragic story of his mentor, The Boss. The theme song Snake Eater is a crucial part of the game's identity, especially during the game's iconic opening cinematic and the long ladder climb sequence, where the music perfectly blends a sense of epic scale and purpose for the player's mission. So guess what's next?
Hey, you gave me one I really like. So it's I Am the Wind by Castlevania, or from Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
There's someone testing me every day I live. Well, the best in me is all I have to give.
So yes, same vocalist. Isn't that cool?
Yep, I've actually played this one all the way through. Symphony of the Night.
Oh, you mean the game? I was about to say, yeah, I know you played this song before. It's on my Halloween list that you
played. No, the game. I'm saying, like, all of these, like, I have not played. This one I played. So, music for I Am the Wind was composed by Rika Muranaka, with additional composition by Tony Haynes and Jeff Lorber. Rika Muranaka is a well-known composer and music producer who worked on a number of Konami's biggest titles. She's particularly known for creating vocal themes for games. Her other notable works include The Best Is Yet to Come from Metal Gear Solid and Can't Say Goodbye to Yesterday from Metal Gear Solid 2. The vocals for the song were performed by Cynthia Harrell, again, here we go, who you may recognize from her work from we just talked about, okay, Snake Eater.
Yeah.
Harrell's performance and soulful voice gives the song a distinct emotional and somewhat melancholic tone. The song's stylistic departure from the rest of the game's gothic and symphonic soundtrack is often a point of discussion among fans, but has become an iconic part of the game's identity. Castlevania Symphony of the Night was developed by Konami Computer Entertainment Tokyo and published by Konami. The game was released on March 20th, 1997 for the PlayStation, and it was later ported to the Sega Saturn and a number of other platforms, including the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 4. The game was directed by Toru Hagahara and Koji Igarashi. Serving assistant director, Igarashi would go on to be a key producer and creator for the Castlevania series. Symphony of the Night was a pivotal entry in the series and moved away from the linear stage-by-stage platforming of previous titles and adopted an exploration-based non-linear design with RPG elements. This style, along with its intricate castle map, would later become the defining characteristics of what now is known as the Metroidvania genre. The game's main score was composed by Michiru Yumani. Michiru Yumani, and was widely praised for its blend of classical, gothic, and jazz influences. The decision to include a J-pop style ballad like I Am the Wind for the end credits was a bit of a surprise, but it serves as a beautiful, bittersweet bookend to Alucard's journey.
Now I've got a bonus for Castlevania. And I had to track down the English version because on the soundtrack thingy that I have, it's all in Japanese. So this is Nocturne, composed also by Michiru Yamane, main composer, of course, for the entire soundtrack. But now, this is interesting because he's known for her mastery of orchestral and gothic music. This track is sweet and melancholic J-pop ballad. The lyrics are written by Masanori Uchi. These are actually performed by Japanese voice actress and singer Hikaru Shinya. Now, this is an Easter egg. So Nocturne is not part of the main game soundtrack that you hear during gameplay. It's a special track that's only found on certain versions of the game. The original Japanese PlayStation version had a unique feature. If you had the fairy card, a familiar that follows Alucard, and leveled it up to level 8, it would sing Nocturne to Alucard. The song was also included on the official Japanese soundtrack CD in Japanese. The song was also included as a hidden track on the game CD itself. If you put the original Symphony of the Night PlayStation disc in a regular CD player, you would hear original Symphony of the Night track 2 on the CD is the song Nocturne, with a brief audio warning from Alucard at the beginning telling you not to play track 1 as it complains Computer Daven, but you probably won't listen to that, will you? Nocturne is a perfect example of a deep cut Easter egg that was a reward for our dedicated players in the game's original release and a treat for fans who bought the soundtrack. It's a sweet personal touch that offers a glimpse into a more gentle side of the dark and gothic world of Castlevania. And I love how you trigger this you have to have a specific fairy card.
Because
there's two different fairies. Mm-hmm. And then you go down to the bottom at castle where there's a chair and you sit down and you wait long enough. Alucard will fall asleep and she sings to him. The little fairy does.
Yeah.
It's really sweet. And so I had to include it as a bonus Easter egg.
Yeah.
Okay. You want this next one?
Ordinary World cover.
Oh, I'm sorry. I took it away before you could read what it's from.
You've been doing that. The Evil Within 2.
Because I have to go and find it, and I'm trying to keep the show flowing. Keep it going. There it is.
But I won't cry for yesterday. There's an ordinary world. Somehow I have to find.
Okay, this original song, Ordinary World, was composed by the members of the band Duran Duran. And that was Warren... Cucurullo?
Yeah, Cucurullo, I think.
Cucurullo, John Nigel Taylor, Nick Rhodes, and Simon John Charles Le Bon. It was a massive hit for them in 1993. The version used in Evil Within 2 is a cover arranged and performed specifically for the game's trailer and end credits. The game's in-house sound team and other collaborators work on this more somber, haunting version. The cover arrangement was done by The Hit House, a music production company that specializes in music for trailers and media. The vocal performance on the game's version of Ordinary World is by an uncredited female vocalist, although the Hit House is credited for the arrangement and performance. The haunting, melancholic tune of the cover with
tone
its
of the cover.
Tone of the cover with its sparse piano and string accompaniment is a significant departure from the Duran Duran's upbeat hip-hop or
pop rock
original. Okay. The Evil Within 2 was developed by Tango Gameworks and published by Bethesda.
Bethesda? You should know the word Bethesda. That's biblical.
Bethesda Softworks. Yeah. You're going to edit this, right, so I sound better. The game was released in October 13th, 2017 for PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and the Microsoft Windows. The game's director was John Jonas.
Johannes. Are you having a hard time reading from this angle?
Who previously directed... Oh, you couldn't tell.
Yeah.
Who had previously directed the DLC for the first game. The original director, Shinji Mikami, took on a supervising producer role. The Evil Within 2 aimed to expand upon the first game's survival horror mechanics and psychological themes, with a greater focus on an open-world hub and a more coherent emotional story centered around a protagonist, Sebastian Castellanos...
Castellanos'
search for his missing daughter. The use of Ordinary World is a crucial part of the game's emotional core. Its lyrics about a person seeking to find a way back to a normal life after experiencing great loss and hardship perfectly align with Sebastian's personal journey. The song plays a key role in the game's ending, providing a powerful and melancholic sense of resolution to Sebastian's long and nightmarish ordeal.
And also, I find it significant, like, you have a male voice singing the verses and then this little girl singing the chorus. And I think I've mentioned this to you before, like, the entire crux of the game is, like, the first game, you discover this weird, horrid machine that creates the psychological world where they were supposed to, oh, we can all live in this almost basically the Matrix, where everything that's your brain makes it real. But somebody's made a horror out of it. And, you know, it's like he destroyed the machine in the first. And then he finds out that they built the second one. They thought, well, the problem is we used that one guy for the core. We needed a more pure, innocent core. So when he thought his daughter had burned to death in this fire, they actually had staged this fire and kidnapped his daughter and used his daughter for the core. But something went wrong years later. But it wrecked his life because he thought his wife and child were both dead in a fire, but they were taken by these people on the machine. Why they picked his, I don't remember. But they said, well, you're one of the people who survived that first machine. Well, something's went wrong. We need somebody to go in and see what's wrong with your daughter in there. Mm. And so the hauntingness of that chorus, having the little girl, is a little girl that they've trapped in this nightmare, wanting out back to the ordinary world instead of the nightmare that they've trapped her in. So you get kind of pissed. In this one, it's different. It's not as scary as the first one to me, because as me, it's just like, you people suck. And I'm going to get my daughter out of here and I'm coming for you. And you do at the end, you lay some waste when you get out of that machine. You get some help from one of the other characters. Just like, you people suck. You're horrible. You've done this to a little girl. And made me think, you know, like, as Sebastian's, that my daughter was burned to death in a fire and he's living with the guilt, the horror that he didn't save his daughter in this fire. And he wasn't, because he wasn't home.
Yeah.
And like, he's got this traumatic thing and he's completely ruined his life. He's lost his job as a police officer. He's just become an alcoholic because he thinks, I should have been there. I could have gotten my wife and daughter out.
I probably won't play this one.
Oh, it's better even than the first one. And they kind of opened the world up.
I didn't watch the, I didn't read.
I know. It's not quite your style, but this was created by the guy who did the original Resident Evil 4. He broke off and did his own game. And these are kind of, both of these games are a little bit underrated by a lot of people, but it's really worth trying. But I thought the second one was so much better. And the weird thing is it's a bit of a mixture of some stealth, because a lot of the horrible things, you don't want it to find you.
Oh, I'd fail at that real fast.
So, and I was the first one I tried to play like a Resident Evil 4, because like, oh, this is a Resident Evil 4 guy. But it's like, no, you're really outgunned. But by the second one, you're a little bit more savvy and you can sneak up on the more monster things and deal with stuff. So, but oh yeah, you're kind of mad through this. It's like, oh, you guys did this to a little girl. To his daughter, to make her the core, because thinking, oh, a pure innocent person would make a nice happy world, but bad people still got in and corrupted the world, and now this poor little girl is trapped in this nightmare. And so your whole mission is, I'm going to get my daughter out of here, and then I'm going to take it out of your butt. You jerks, you. Okay, so now I get to do the Roy Orbison song, In Dreams, as featured in Alan Wake. But In Dreams was written and performed by the legendary American singer-songwriter Roy Orbison. Released in 1963, the song is a classic rock pop ballad known for its dramatic structure and Orbison's impressive vocal range, particularly his signature powerful falsetto. The song's eerie, dreamlike quality and its themes of love and longing are central to its use in the game. Alan Wake was developed by Remedy Entertainment and published by Microsoft Game Studios. We're going to be hanging around with Remedy for a few songs. The game was released May 18th, 2010 on the Xbox 360 with a PC version following in 2012, later remastered for PlayStation 4, PlayStation 5, Xbox One, Xbox Series X and S, and PC in 2021, and I played the remastered. The game's lead writer and director was Sam Lake, who is known for his work on the Max Payne series. The game's unique structure, which is divided into episodes like a TV show, which was pretty cool, was a key part of its production and narrative design. The use of In Dreams is a clear and direct homage to the film Blue Velvet by director David Lynch, who also features the song in a memorable, unsettling scene. This connection is not a coincidence, as Remedy has often cited David Lynch and the TV show Twin Peaks as major influences on Alan Wake's tone, setting, and surrealistic horror elements. The song plays at a key moment between episodes, often over a transition or cinematic sequence, reinforcing the game's blurring of reality and dreams. The lyrics perfectly reflect the protagonist Alan Wake's state of mind as he struggles to distinguish between what is real and what is a nightmare created by the dark presence. The song's presence is a masterstroke in setting a tone that is both nostalgic and deeply unsettling. And part of it, like he's trying to find his wife, what happened to his wife that was taken away by the dark presence. And so it kind of fits. That Roy Orbison song very well. So the music and lyrics for The Poet and the Muse were written by... Oh, wait a minute. This is more stuff from Alan Wake. So the music and lyrics for The Poet and the Muse were written by Poets of the Fall, specifically Marco Soresto and Marcus Karlonen. They are European. The song's composition is a perfect example of how Remedy and Poets of the Fall create music that is deeply integrated into the game's lore. The lyrics of The Poet and the Muse are a direct summary of the story of Thomas Zane and his muse, a story that is at the heart of the game's central mystery. This was performed by, as they credit in the game, performed by Old Gods of Asgard. They are a fictional band in the Alan Wake universe. Also, you'll find them pop up in Control. And we might, you know, they're, I've heard about from remaking Max Payne. Maybe they'll connect Max Payne into this Remedy universe. So as with other songs from the fictional world, the vocals were performed by Poets of the Fall's lead singer, Marco Soresto. So this song is part of the game's climax, playing during a sequence in the game's fifth episode. As the player, Alan Wake, finds himself at the Anderson Farm, a home to the two brothers who are members of Old Gods of Asgard, which they might actually be like Odin and Loki or Thor or something, you know. When the dark presence attacks, the music kicks in and the stage lights up, creating a surreal and unforgettable battle arena. Basically, you're playing like a metal concert with pyrotechnics because everything's vulnerable to light. So the pyrotechnics is hurting all the monsters. It's pretty cool. The gameplay becomes a choreographed fight scene with the pulsing music providing a rhythm for the player's combat against the Taken. The Poet and the Muse is a masterclass in cinematic and ludonarrative design. Okay, that's a new word for me. It's not just a song playing in the background. It's part of the story, a weapon against the darkness, and an unforgettable climax to a major act of the game. The song is a direct reference to the game's lore about the Poet and the Muse from the manuscript pages, blurring the line between the fictional band's song, the game's lore, and the player's experience. It's this kind of detail that has made Remedy Entertainment a fan favorite for so many years. Now another Remedy game.
This is Take Control from Control. Okay, the song Take Control was composed and written by members of the Finnish rock band Poets of the Fall, primarily Marco Soresto, lead vocals and lyrics, Marcus Karlonen, which is a composer, and Olli Tuukkanen, the composer. The song was created specifically for the game, a continuation of the long-standing collaboration between Promise of the Fall and developer Remedy Entertainment. The song was performed by the fictional band Old Gods of Asgard, which is a pseudonym used by Poets of the Fall within the Remedy-connected universe. This fictional band first appeared in Remedy's 2010 game Alan Wake, which we just talked about.
Yeah, we could probably skip ahead because it's going to repeat you a little bit, isn't it?
Okay, they were portrayed by rock band in the Bright Town, in the found town of Bright Falls,
Washington.
Let's just
jump down here.
Who are also brothers and paratutelarians, people with supernatural abilities. And then we already did that. Okay, so
yeah,
Control
so
was developed by Remedy Entertainment and published by 505 Games. The game was released on August 27th, 2019 for PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and Microsoft Windows. The game's director was Michael Kasurinen. And the creative director was Sam Lake, who has a long history of working with Poets of the Fall. The Ashtray Maze sequence is a perfect example of Remedy's unique approach to the game design. The entire sequence is choreographed to the song Take Control, with the environment shifting and pulsating beat synced to their music as the protagonist, Jesse Faden, fights her way through an ever-changing labyrinth. Production of Take Control was more complex than a typical game song. According to interviews, the band had to break the song down into different parts that could be dynamically stitched together in the game's engine, allowing it to respond to the player's movements and actions. This created an experience where the music and the environment were in perfect lockstep, making the player feel like a true...
bad rear.
Yeah. Yeah. Take Control is not just a song, it's a piece of the game's lore. The lyrics are a direct commentary on Jesse Faden's story. Her relationship
I think
with
you got it. No, it might be I haven't played it in a little while.
Her relationship with Hiss and her journey to become the director of the Federal Bureau of Control is a fantastic example of a band and a developer working together to create something that's more than the sum of its parts.
Okay, now there is a bonus song in here. The song My Dark Disquiet was also written, of course, by Poets of the Fall, and it was actually released on their album Ultraviolet in 2018, so it's a pre-existing track that Remedy chose to integrate into the game's lore. Okay, so this is part of, once again, there being the old gods of Asgard within the Control universe, and so the game's lore connects the song to the Prime Candidate Program, which is a project that was looking for individuals who could become the next director of the Bureau. The song itself is said to be a tune of chaos that was used to test the candidate's resilience to paranormal influence. So basically there's like this room, like a studio, where they have people come and sit to listen to the song to see if it has the supernatural reaction of them. You would probably like Control because there are ways you can set up to where you cannot die. But the tricky part is when Jesse starts getting all these different powers, she starts to where you can float and fly around the room, and it's a little harder maybe to control, and I think you would struggle with that. But, I mean, Jesse becomes pretty daggum awesome when she starts out very kind of ordinary, but becomes pretty awesome by the end as she gains all these powers from the Mjolnir gun. Okay, I think we are on the last couple songs. I know this has been going on a long time.
This has been going on for a long time.
But it's good stuff. It's good stuff. Okay, I'm going to try to shorten this down just a little bit. So, I guess I'll just do this one. Go Tell Aunt Rhody, as portrayed or as performed in Resident Evil 7.
I was raised in a deep, dark hole. A prisoner with no parole. They locked me up and took my soul.
So the to just kind of briefly sum up this one, they rewrote lyrics to Resident Evil occasionally likes to have you pity the monster you just killed. Sometimes I kind of started with Resident Evil 4, where they the original Resident Evil 4 and kind of in the remake, they like to show you images of how the villagers were before the bad people came in to remind you, like, these people you just had to kill that were monsters weren't always monsters. The real monsters are the people who make the monsters. And you don't always get your hands on them. And this is basically they created a little girl to give her all these powers. And all she really wanted was what a little girl would want. She wanted a family, but she didn't understand how family works. And so with her powers, she's kind of gets a little twisted and turns a nice family, the Bakers, into monsters. And basically that's lyric is her is. So they just locked her away. They wouldn't let her be normal and they were kind of ashamed of what they'd done, perhaps, that they made this little girl into a monster. And the sad part on this game is when you finally have to finish her, you realize this old woman you see sitting in the chair is really the little girl, Evelyn. She didn't age. She ages fast. So she grew from a little girl into this old woman. And the last thing she says before she dies is, why does everyone hate me? And it's like, oh, you're like, I'm sorry, but you were a monster. Like, we had to stop you. But it's like, there. That's part of what kind of makes Resident Evil work. As you, when you think about all these zombies in those early games, they were people. They're victims too. So they get you on two levels. So, and this song really fits with that from coming from Evelyn's perspective. Because it kind of reminds you, oh, by the way, yeah, this was a little girl and these people did this. But you never seem to get your hands on the punks who do it. So, yeah. All right. So it's a traditional folk song, though. The origins are debated, but it's actually a very old piece of music. Now, the version in here was arranged by Michael A. Levine, who's an American composer, music producer, and violinist, known for his work in film and television. And he brought about, of course, a new version of there. The vocals on this, done by American singer Jordan Rain. And I'm going to just speed right along here. This was released January 24th by Capcom on multiple systems. And okay, I'm going to let you do this one. I'm going to call this the last one. There's a little bit about stuff about the remaster I might show you later, because I remember I was talking about this. They recently released a remaster of this entire game series, but they cast voices for the characters, which means this song was going to be recorded by somebody else instead of the original singer. But I know you like this, so I'm going to let you do this.
So this is Wind's Nocturne.
This is from Silver Star Story Complete, also known as the Boat Song. See, look, I let you have this one.
Yes, you gave me a couple of good ones.
I gave you this one specifically because you're getting tired.
Yeah, I am. I got things to do before I can go to bed. Music for Wind's Nocturne was composed by Noriyuki Itaware, a prolific and beloved Japanese video game composer. Itaware is known for his work on a number of classic series, including Grandia, Ace Attorney, and of course, Lunar. He has a knack for creating memorable, emotive melodies. The song's full title is Kaze no Nocturne in Japanese. The original version of the song is a beautiful instrumental piece, and later remakes a vocal version of the song was created. Vocals for this version were performed by Ri Kujimiya.
Something like that.
Yeah, Kujimiya, a well-known Japanese voice actress and singer. The original release of Lunar Silver Star was on the Sega CD in 1992. The game was developed by Game Arts and published by Victor Interactive Software in Japan and by Working Designs in North America. The original Sega CD version featuring the song was a purely instrumental track, which I mentioned before, with powerful melody carried by a MIDI-like sound, and it is still a very impactful and emotional piece of music. Okay, so there's been some remakes. So Lunar Silver Star Complete... Silver Star Story Complete is from Sega Saturn.
And this is the version we just heard. It was from this version.
Okay. So this is on Sega Saturn and PlayStation in 1996 and 1998, where the major change occurred. The game was given a significant overhaul with updated graphics and cutscenes and a completely re-recorded, higher-quality soundtrack. The song Wind's Nocturne was given new orchestral arrangements, and a vocal version was added, which would become the definitive version for many fans. The addition of the lyrics further cemented the song's emotional resonance with the game's themes of love, destiny, and adventure. For the English language version of Wind's Nocturne on Lunar Silver Story Star...
you can skip that. Just, vocalist Jenny Stiegel.
Yeah, sorry.
You don't have to keep saying it every time because you're tripping all over that thing.
I am. I'm sorry.
Okay. And we don't have to talk about so much as it was in the other version, but this is the version that we're familiar with, even though I've never got to play it, but I wanted to because like they had done this with several songs and fully animated the cutscenes like an anime. And so now it's recently been remastered and re-released in 2025, but it's got a new English voice cast, and they let the new voice actress perform it. I'll let you hear it here in a bit. It's good, but I guess I'm still stuck on like the original.
Yeah, sometimes song. That happens with the song. The first time you hear it,
it's good. But this the actress that's now voicing Luna has a kind of a deeper resonance and a lower resonance to her voice, so it doesn't have the same tone. But she does a good job of it. But I'll have you hear that later. But that wraps up all of the songs that I had on the list here. So let me remind you about Podgagement. You'll find out about it at neverlandpodcast.com. It's on there. That's Daniel J. Lewis's fantastic company. If you happen to have a podcast, believe me, he's got services for you. Let's thank Karen Kennedy, Ricky Pope of Christian Nerds Unite, Darren O'Hillhide of the Will Hyten Wall Show. Email us, podcast@neverlandpodcast.com. Find us on X, Neverland PCast. We're on Facebook as the Phantom X, is also as Neverland Podcast. You'll find a like page and a group. Please go to Patreon and become a donor, because you'll get ad-free shows, because you'll notice there were ads at the beginning, ads at the end, and I'm going to interrupt our song countdown there with more ads in the middle. And if you don't want to hear those ads, you'll get into your own RSS feed through Patreon, where you never have to hear that. Also, Red Circle has an exclusive membership, and I put ad-free versions of the show on there as well. All right, no copyright. This is very important to hear. No copyright infringement is intended, and copyright is held by their respective owners. Content is shared for review and commentary purposes under fair use license. And it's very important to say that in an episode such as this, where we use so many audio clips. And now, get lost in an adventure.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.